Take your Bibles and let us turn to the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel chapter 1, and I'll be reading from 1:1 through chapter 3, verse 15. So Ezekiel 1:1 through 3:15, we'll give our children a moment to go ahead and leave. Some of the children see this as their Exodus moment. For others, it might the teachers see this as their exile moment. Okay, so Ezekiel chapter 1, and I'll start at verse 1, and then I'll read on down through verse 15 of chapter 3. All of this holds together, and we're not going to tackle it all this morning, but we need to hear the whole thing kind of as one episode. So Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 1. In the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day, while I was among the exiles by the Kibar River, the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. On the fifth of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim, the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, by the Kibar River in the land of the Babylonians. There the hand of the Lord was upon him. I looked, and I saw a windstorm coming out of the north, an immense cloud with flashing lightning and surrounded by brilliant light. The center of the fire looked like glowing metal, and in the fire was what looked like four living creatures. In appearance, their form was that of a man, but each of them had four faces and four wings. Their legs were straight, their feet were like those of a calf, and gleamed like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides, they had the hands of a man. All four of them had faces and wings, and their wings touched one another. Each one went straight ahead. They did not turn as they moved. Their faces looked like this. Each of the four had the face of a man, and on the right side, each had the face of a lion, and on the left, the face of an ox. Each also had the face of an eagle. Such were their faces. Their wings were spread out upward. Each had two wings, one touching the wing of another creature on either side, and two wings covering its body. Each one went straight ahead. Wherever the spirit would go, they would go without turning as they went. The appearance of the living creatures was like burning coals of fire, or like torches. Fire moved back and forth among the creatures. It was bright, and lightning flashed out of it. The creatures sped back and forth like flashes of lightning. As I looked at the living creatures, I saw a wheel on the ground beside each creature with its four faces. This was the appearance and structure of the wheels. They sparkled like chrysolite, and all four looked alike. Each appeared to be made like a wheel intersecting a wheel. As they moved, they would go in any one of the four directions the creatures faced. The wheels did not turn about as the creatures went. Their rims were high and awesome, and all four rims were full of eyes all around. When the living creatures moved, the wheels beside them moved, and when the living creatures rose from the ground, the wheels also rose. Wherever the spirit would go, they would go, and the wheels would rise along with them, because the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When the creatures moved, they also moved. When the creatures stood still, they also stood still. And when the creatures rose from the ground, the wheels rose along with them, because the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. Spread out above the heads of the living creatures was what looked like an expanse, sparkling like ice and awesome. Under the expanse, their wings were stretched out one toward the other, and each had two wings covering its body. When the creatures moved, I heard the sound of their wings like the roar of rushing waters, like the voice of the Almighty, like the tumult of an army. When they stood still, they lowered their wings. Then there came a voice from above the expanse over their heads as they stood with lowered wings. Above the expanse over their heads was what looked like a throne of sapphire, and high above on the throne was a figure like that of a man. I saw that from what appeared to be his waist up, he looked like glowing metal, as if full of fire, and that from there down he looked like fire, and brilliant light surrounded him. Like the appearance of a rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the radiance around him. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. When I saw it, I fell face down, and I heard the voice of one speaking. He said to me, "Son of man, "Stand up on your feet, and I will speak to you." As he spoke, the Spirit came into me and raised me to my feet, and I heard him speaking to me. He said, "Son of man, I am sending you to the Israelites, to a rebellious nation that has rebelled against me. They and their fathers have been in revolt against me to this very day. The people to whom I am sending you are obstinate and stubborn. Say to them, 'This is what the Sovereign Lord says.' And whether they listen or fail to listen, for they are a rebellious house, they will know that a prophet has been among them. And you, son of man, do not be afraid of them or their words. Do not be afraid, though briars and thorns are all around you, and you live among scorpions. Do not be afraid of what they say or terrified by them, though they are a rebellious house. You must speak my words to them, whether they listen or fail to listen, for they are rebellious. But you, son of man, listen to what I say to you. Do not rebel like that rebellious house. Open your mouth and eat what I give you." Then I looked, and I saw a hand stretched out to me. In it was a scroll, which he unrolled before me. On both sides of it were written words of lament and mourning and woe. And he said to me, "Son of man, eat what is before you. Eat this scroll. Then go and speak to the house of Israel." So I opened my mouth, and he gave me the scroll to eat. And then he said to me, "Son of man, eat this scroll I am giving you, and fill your stomach with it." So I ate it, and it tasted as sweet as honey in my mouth. He then said to me, "Son of man, go now to the house of Israel and speak my words to them. You are not being sent to a people of obscure speech and difficult language, but to the house of Israel. Not to many peoples of obscure speech and difficult language whose words you cannot understand. Surely I have sent you to them. If I had sent you to them, they would have listened to you. But the house of Israel is not willing to listen to you because they are not willing to listen to me. For the whole house of Israel is hardened and obstinate. But I will make you as unyielding and hardened as they are. I will make your forehead like the hardest stone, harder than flint. Do not be afraid of them or terrified by them, though they are a rebellious house." And he said to me, "Son of man, listen carefully and take to heart all the words I speak to you. Go now to your countrymen in exile and speak to them. Say to them, 'This is what the Sovereign Lord says,' whether they listen or fail to listen." Then the Spirit lifted me up, and I heard behind me a loud rumbling sound. May the glory of the Lord be praised in his dwelling place. The sound of the wings of the living creatures brushing against each other, and the sound of the wheels beside them, a loud rumbling sound. The Spirit then lifted me up and took me away, and I went in bitterness and in the anger of my spirit with the strong hand of the Lord upon me. I came to the exiles who lived at Tel Aviv near the Kibar River, and there where they were living, I sat among them for 7 days, overwhelmed. Let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you for your many blessings upon us, and thank you for speaking to us. We pray that as we come before your word today, that you would speak afresh to us, that you would give us ears to hear you. May our hearts be receptive to you, and we pray that we would be obedient to you. Have your way amongst us, we ask. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, lots of questions. Your first question might be, why Ezekiel? Well, I've never really preached through Ezekiel before. I've done some Bible studies in Ezekiel. I've done some sermons from different places in Ezekiel. But I've never really worked all the way through the whole book of Ezekiel. And so I kind of felt like, well, maybe it's about time. I mean, I've done Genesis, I've done Exodus, I've done Deuteronomy, I've done Joshua, I've done Acts, I've done John, I've done Mark, I've done Luke, I've done Romans, I've done Philippians a couple of times. I mean, I've done lots of stuff, even did Proverbs for a little while. But I've never really given Ezekiel kind of a thorough read or study. And I just felt like, wow, it's probably about time. And so that's kind of why Ezekiel, this sense that, okay, I need to give, this is one of, a major prophetic book in the Old Testament, and there's some really powerful stuff in it, and just felt like, okay, maybe this is the time. The other thing, just so you know, and maybe you recognize this already, but I do feel like we need to read from the whole Bible, that we just can't settle in and, you know, read the Gospels or just our favorite passages or our favorite places, that we really do need to kind of be working our way through all of Scripture. And so my tendency is to do something kind of Old Testament, something New Testament, and to kind of go back and forth, make sure we get a gospel in there, make sure we get some of the letters, make sure we get different sections of the Old Testament. And so I just kind of have the sense that it's time to give some attention to Ezekiel, and that guy's breaks as well. So Ezekiel. And so with that, there are some questions that come up right away, and we get those even just in the first paragraph, is who is Ezekiel, and where is Ezekiel, and how did Ezekiel get to be where he's at? And so I want to work at that for a little bit, and that's going to, it's kind of a large answer, those questions that kind of seem so simple. Where is he and who is he and how did he get to where he's at? And so we'll work on that some, and then we'll work into the throne vision a little bit. And really, we're only going to get to the end of chapter 1. And hopefully we'll get to the end of chapter 1. So, and there is lunch coming. And I think I saw Mr. Dan being given the coupon to go get the pizzas. And so I know that when I see Mr. Dan leave, the pressure is on to wrap it up. So we'll see what we can do. I saw that, Dan. Okay. So who is Ezekiel? Well, the first thing I want to say about Ezekiel we get from our text here is that he is a priest. And so Ezekiel was born into this line of priests, and so he would have spent his life preparing to serve in the temple in Jerusalem. And the service period was roughly from age 30 to age 50. So you can just imagine spending the first 30 years of your life growing up in this family, knowing that the job of your family was to serve as priest in the temple in Jerusalem. And so you spend the first 30 years of your life really kind of preparing for this office. And then once you have reached preparation, once you have reached maturity, then at age 30, you would be assigned responsibilities within the service of the temple. They would offer sacrifices in the morning and the evening. You would do the priestly work of teaching. You would do the priestly work of offering other sacrifices, the priestly work of praying for your people, the priestly work of blessing people. And so you would spend the first 30 years of your life preparing for this office, and it would be your privilege, your honor, to carry out this office for 20 years. So from age 30 to age 50, that was your prime time to serve as a priest in the Jerusalem temple. So that's a little bit about who Ezekiel is. Now, where is he? Well, he is by the Kibar River in Babylon. Okay, that's not the normal place for a priest to hang out. Okay, so how did he get there? Well, this is where it gets a little bit kind of expansive in terms of knowing the story or being able to tell the story of Ezekiel. And so we'll back it up a little bit from this moment here. So we're in Palestine, and there are major empires, and everybody really kind of wants to control Palestine. If you have a map in the back of your Bible, or you're sitting close to someone, or you can pull it up on your phone, just kind of the Middle East, but you can kind of see where Jerusalem is at, and it's in Palestine or the land of Canaan, and then to the south of Jerusalem, further south you have Egypt, and Egypt has the Nile River running through it. And then if you go north, you have Syria, and you get up there and you kind of begin to wrap around further east, and you follow the Tigris and the Euphrates, and that takes you through Assyria and down to Babylon. And so he's there. And the major empire of Ezekiel's day was Babylon. The Babylonians had defeated the Assyrians and kind of taken over them roughly 612 BC, thereabouts. They were actually going to end up pushing on down and taking over Egypt. And whatever empire of the day was, and in Ezekiel's day it was Babylon, but all the empires wanted to control Palestine. And the reason why they wanted to control Palestine was that was kind of the trade route. That's where the roads went from down in Egypt up to Syria and over and down to Babylon, as well as on up and around and like you were going to go to Europe. And so controlling those roads were important. It was a major source of income. You could tax all of the commerce. Nobody ever went straight across the desert to Babylon. They always went from Egypt up and around, or from Babylon, you know, around and down through Palestine, down through Canaan to Egypt. And so if you controlled those roads, that was a major source of income, major revenue. Plus, it gave you a buffer in terms of fighting battles there instead of on your home turf. Plus, you got to tax the people who were there. So empire after empire wanted to control that territory. And the Assyrian Empire used to control it. And then when the Babylonians conquered the Assyrians, they weren't going to stop at Assyria. They were going to come on down and take over Palestine, take over Jerusalem. Well, in the 620s, the way things were kind of set up, Jerusalem actually experienced a measure of independence. So when I say 620s, it's about 620 BC, 630 BC in that time period. And so Babylon wasn't super strong yet, but Assyria was getting weaker. And the Egyptians, you know, their glory days were behind them. And so it was a time period in which Jerusalem was able to experience a little bit of strength, a little bit of security. And the king, his name was Josiah. And Josiah, during this time period, had started a reform. They had found the Book of the Covenant in the temple and began to realize, wow, we're not really living true to Yahweh in this covenant that we have with Yahweh. And so Josiah began to initiate a reform so that Jerusalem really became the worship center for all of the Jews. And so the temple became even more kind of a place that was flourishing and thriving. And this reform is going on. Well, what happened was that Josiah decided that he wanted to stop the Egyptians from going to help the Assyrians fight the Babylonians. Hopefully you stayed with me right there. So the Babylonians are growing in power, and so they're going to take over Assyria, and Egypt is worried about the Babylonians taking over. Because if they take over Assyria, then there's nothing really stopping the Babylonians from coming down the coast of the Mediterranean and fighting the Egyptians and taking over Egypt. And so the Egyptians are kind of smart, and they think it'd be better to stop the Babylonians up there to Syria rather than have them come down and have to stop them in your own land. So they're going to march up to try to help the Assyrians stop the Babylonians. Well, when they march up to help the Assyrians, what land do they have to march through? They got to march through Palestine. They got to march through Josiah's territory. Josiah does not want, as far as we can tell, Josiah does not want to be known as one who opposed Babylon. You want to be on the right side of Babylon. And so he decides that he is going to stop the Egyptians from making this journey to help the Assyrians. Well, he got killed in battle. He did not succeed at stopping them. And this is roughly 612 that this happens. And so he is killed in battle, and that's kind of the end of the reform. And when they lose Josiah, it's like the reform is over. They still have prophets. Jeremiah is a prophet during this time, but the reform is kind of over. Since the Egyptians defeated Jerusalem at that point, then they placed a king on the throne that they thought would be loyal to them. And that king's name was Jehoiakim. And Jehoiakim was king for about 12 years. And we could go into the various issues of his reign, but we won't. What you need to know is that he died kind of just in the nick of time. He died about 598, and the Babylonians were coming. And so his son came to the throne, and his son's name was Jehoiakim, with an N at the end. You'll see his name there in the text in verse 2. On the fifth of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim. That king came to the throne about 598 BC. So the Babylonians are kind of the powerful empire right now, but following in the steps of his fathers to some extent, Jehoiakim kind of moved back and forth trying to negotiate with which empire was the strongest, with which empire would kind of give him the most liberty, the most power. And so he had gone back and forth between Egypt and Babylon, and he should have been with Babylon, and he was trying to rebel against Babylon, and the Babylonians came. Well, he died, and Jehoiakim, his son, probably about 18 years old at the time, became king. And he became king just in time to be surrounded by the Babylonians. And the Babylonians surrounded Jerusalem, and the Babylonians took Jehoiakim prisoner. So imagine that. You become king just in time to be taken captive. And he was taken captive to Babylon. And this is about 598. And when the Babylonians would come, when they came and took people captive, what they did was they tried to take those with power, those with education, those with influence. And so they took the king, and they also took several priests, and they took several people of kind of noble birth and people that had education, kind of the upper crust, if you will. So they would take them captive, and it wasn't just the Jews. Whoever they took captive, they did this with. And you relocate them closer to Babylon, and you try to make use of them. You make use of their skills. You make use of their intelligence. You make use of their power. And the other thing that they would try to do is that they would settle them in kind of the blighted areas of their city or the blighted areas of their territory. You would settle them there as a way to try to renovate that territory. So if you had a war-torn part of your country and you had conquered another people, then you would bring kind of their leadership, their most educated, their best trained, and you would resettle them in that area of your empire that needs redeveloped. And so that's what happened with Ezekiel. That Ezekiel was taken captive in 598 and resettled in Babylon along the Kibar River in this place that kind of needed some redevelopment. Now, let's see, what else do we need to get here? 598 wasn't the end of it. So when the Babylonians brought Jehoiakim captive to Babylon, they placed one of his relatives, Zedekiah, on the throne. And Zedekiah was to be a vassal king. He was supposed to be loyal to Babylon, and he was supposed to collect taxes and all of that stuff for the Babylonians. And as long as he did that, they would make sure that he governed that territory. Because if you're an empire, you do need people to govern your territories. And one of the ways that they would have their territories governed was they would kind of set up what's referred to as vassal kings. Not an independent king, but a king that was propped up by the empire to collect taxes for the empire and to maintain order and loyalty to the empire. Well, Zedekiah had other things in mind after a while. And he wanted to, I guess, maybe be the hero and liberate Jerusalem from Babylon. And he shouldn't have. And what ended up happening is in 587, so again, about a dozen years, 11 years or so after he's placed on the throne, he rebels, and this time the Babylonians come and they absolutely crush Jerusalem. They don't put anybody else on the throne. It's now going to be ruled by a governor and not a king. They totally destroyed the temple. The temple that Ezekiel had dreamed and prepared of giving 20 years of service to, totally destroyed, shambled, not one stone left on another. The city was burned to where it became uninhabitable, and the exile was deepened so that more people were taken captive to Babylon. Some people were able to escape down to Egypt, and basically you just had the poorest of the poor left there in Jerusalem. So this is kind of the time period that Ezekiel is in. And, well, a couple other kind of background things to get at. So did you notice the dating here? So in the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day, while I was among the exiles by the Kibar River, the heavens were opened and I saw visions of God. Now notice what happens in verse 2. On the fifth of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim, the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel. Notice two things. One, we shifted persons. So in verse 1, we have this I language. So Ezekiel is telling his story. In verse 2, now Ezekiel is in the third person. And so somebody is telling us about Ezekiel, kind of bringing some clarification. And it looks like one of the things that's being clarified is the time. So Ezekiel says in the 30th year, verse 2 says in the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim. So the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim would have been, well, Jehoiakim was exiled about 598 or 597, depending upon, you know, who you read. So 5 years into that, it would have been roughly 593. So 5 years into the exile. Now notice, we're 5 years into exile, at least in terms of Jehoiakim, but Jerusalem is still standing. It's not going to be for another till we get to 587. So we're at 593, 590, 587. So it won't be for another 6 years until everything is totally crushed and destroyed. So we're kind of in between here, between this first exile, Jehoiakim taken captive, and then the fall in 587, where Zedekiah, King Zedekiah, where he is taken captive. Maybe just one side note. When Zedekiah is taken captive because of his rebellion and resistance, Jehoiakim was fairly compliant. Zedekiah, when he was taken captive, they tried to escape instead of surrender. And so the Babylonians captured Zedekiah and his sons, and they executed his sons right in front of him. And then they gouged out his eyes and led him away captive, so that the last thing he saw was the execution of his family. And then he served the rest of his life as a prisoner in Babylon, blind. Just the horrors of it. So we're 5 years in when this happens. He gets this vision. And notice it says, he says, the 30th year. So scholars don't really know how to understand the 30th year, but kind of the prevailing opinion is that Ezekiel is talking about his 30th year. 30 years old. In my 30th year, this is the vision I saw. Now, what was supposed to be happening to him at age 30? He was supposed to be entering into his service at the temple, everything that he had prepared for. And instead of being able to enter into the temple and fulfill what he had prepared for all of his life, he finds himself a captive in Babylon. Far, far, far from the temple. Means he would have been taken captive when he was about 25 years old. So 25 years old, taken captive. The temple's still standing. He probably had some hope of maybe returning and being able to fulfill his lifelong dream, his lifelong calling, everything he had prepared for. 5 years of kind of hoping and longing that maybe, just maybe, somehow God will get me back there. And can you imagine when it dawns on him that everything he had prepared for isn't going to happen? That he's 30 years old and he's not going to go into the temple in Jerusalem. He's 30 years old and there he is in Babylon. Go with me to chapter 40. Chapter 40, verse 1. In the 25th year of our exile, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th of the month, in the 14th year after the fall of the city, on that very day the hand of the Lord was on me and he took me there. And it gives him another vision. The thing I want to point out today is, what year was it? In the 25th year of our exile. What do we have back at 1:2? The fifth year of our exile. So where did he spend his years that he should have spent in the temple? Babylon. 20 years in Babylon. 20 years not getting to do what he was prepared to do, what he was trained to do, what he was born to do. And so I don't know that we can really grasp the displacement that Ezekiel must have felt. Just the sheer displacement in terms of growing up thinking that you got this life in front of you. And then all of a sudden being totally taken out of that place, not just out of that place, but out of that life. Being totally taken out of that life and what you were born to do, what you were prepared to do, what you had trained to do, what you had dreamed of doing, given yourself to do, plucked up from there and carried into a whole different world as a captive, and then to spend the next 20 years there instead of the 20 years of service in the temple. Just incredible displacement. Now the book of Ezekiel would have been put together sometime after that. So realize what we have in chapter 1 here, chapters 1 to 3. What we have here is Ezekiel reflecting back, remembering, narrating what happened when he turned 30, 5 years into the exile. So he's kind of on the other side of these 20 years, kind of looking back. We don't know if he wrote it as he went. We don't know if he wrote the whole thing on the other side of it. We don't know if he kept a journal or shared things with people and then somebody else put it all together on the other side. But just realize that the book of Ezekiel, it's on the other side, you know, of his 20 years. But here we're getting this memory, if you will, of when it hit him that he's 30 years old and he doesn't get to do what he was prepared to do, what he was born to do. Far, far away from the temple. Okay, are you with me on that? I feel like I should take a break and ask for questions. I know that's a lot of stuff to take in, but any comments or questions, anything need clarified? You kind of get the picture? We're kind of good? Okay, it almost feels like Monday. Okay, so we got this young priest and 30 years old, and he's been a captive for 5 years. He's been exiled, and where are we? Oh, the vision. So this is the thing. Notice the end of verse 3. There the hand of the Lord was upon him. He had been taken a long way from where he thought he was supposed to be. He had been taken a long way from doing what he thought he was born to do. But there, the hand of the Lord was upon him. And I just pause there, and we may circle back to this, but the hand of the Lord is never too short to reach, no matter where you've been taken to. That a lot of times, we end up in places where we didn't think we were born to be. We end up in places that seem far from what we may have trained ourselves to do. We end up in places where maybe it seems like it is an absolutely God-forsaken place. A place that has been messed up by war. A place where maybe we're supposed to go in and make a life in a war-torn area. A place where it's just nobody else wants to be. I mean, we can end up in places where nobody wants to be, but even in those places, God's hand is long enough, his reach is long enough to be able to rest his hand upon us. He rested his hand upon Ezekiel. Must have been a little shocking. I don't know Ezekiel. But I'm just imagining that when he turned 30, he must have thought that, wow, his life is beyond God's reach. That if God's hand were upon him, he would be in the temple. He wouldn't have been taken captive. He would have been spared. And yet here he is in Babylon, seemingly out of reach, and he discovers that God's hand is upon him. And then the vision comes. Now the vision is, it takes up all of chapter 1. Ezekiel is blessed with kind of three of these visions in his life. And we're just going to look at chapter 1 today. And there's so much that I don't understand that I imagine it will be brief. But let me just share a new word with you, or at least what I expect will be a new word. Theophany. Okay, theophany, you use that word in the past week. Anybody had a theophany? Yeah. It's not a word that I use often either, but it's two words put together. Theos, God, and phaneo, Greek word, means to appear. And so a theophany is an appearance of God. And so it's kind of a technical word to describe what's going on here. There is a theophany taking place. And what's really interesting about this theophany is that there are two major aspects to it. So one common theophany was God appearing in a storm. And so you can think a little bit like Moses was at Mount Sinai, and they're up there, and it's like there's this huge storm breaking out, and God's in the storm. And there's lightning, and there's thunder, and the dark clouds, and God kind of shows up in the storm. So that was one way that was kind of not unique to Ezekiel, but was kind of common in the Old Testament and even across cultures back then, was to imagine, visualize kind of the appearance of God showing up in this awesome, terrible storm. And usually this language and this imagery was used kind of God as a storm God, this theophany. And what this would mean was God was kind of at war, that God was kind of going to let somebody have it. And usually it was thought of that, okay, the storm God is going to protect us from our enemies, that God is going to show up and the lightning bolts are heading towards our enemies. And you can kind of think of the Exodus and going through the sea and that type of thing. But it could also be a sign of judgment. That God was showing up, but the judgment wasn't coming on the enemies. The judgment was coming upon us, or the judgment coming upon Israel, the people of God. So he has this theophany. And the first part of the theophany is this storm of wind that's coming out of the north. The second kind of theophany that gets pulled into it is kind of like what we saw in Revelation, where you have a heavenly vision of God or a throne vision. So you got the storm vision and you got the throne vision. And in the throne vision, what usually happens are kind of like what we saw in Revelation, where the heavens are open, kind of peeled back, and you get to see God on the throne. And so we have this kind of combination. The storm theophany, it's usually kind of a God who comes. And in the throne theophany, it's not so much that God is coming as much as it is the heavens are kind of open and you get to see kind of in the other realm. Well, both of those are pulled together here. So it's kind of a unique combination of those two. Now, we quickly transition from the storm theophany to kind of a throne theophany, but we don't see the throne till kind of the end of the chapter. Instead, the first thing we really begin to meet are these four creatures. And these four creatures have four faces, and each creature has two sets of wings, four faces. So the face looking forward, the face over this side, the face that side, the face behind. And the four faces are what? The face looking forward, that's the face of a human being. The face that's off to the right is the face of a lion. The face that's off to the left is the face of an ox. And the face that's behind is the face of an eagle. So these four-faced creatures with two sets of wings, and then their feet are like calves' feet. So they're kind of a weird creature. And these four-faced creatures are kind of connected to each other, and they're moving about, and we really don't understand their job, so to speak, till we get closer to the end of the chapter. And there what we discover is basically that they are holding up the sky. Okay, so in kind of the ancient world and the artwork, you would often have these kind of half human, half angelic, half beastly, I know that's three halves, but kind of these kind of weird creatures that were part human, part superhuman, angelic, but also part beastly. And these creatures, their job was to kind of hold the sky. And we think of the sky as atmosphere and something that you easily kind of pass through. Well, they thought of the sky much more as kind of a dome. And so you have this dome that is kind of holding, keeping the rains from crashing in. So you have these beasts, creatures, I don't know what else to call them, and their job is basically holding up the sky. And it's this firmament. So don't think of sky as atmosphere or the places that the birds fly. What you need to think about is the dome that allows for space for the birds to fly in. So the dome, they're holding the dome up. And then typically what we find, and we find it exactly here at the end of the chapter, that sitting on the dome of the sky is a throne. And God is seated on that throne. So here are these four creatures holding up the sky on which the throne of God is setting. So God reigns over the sky. God reigns over these creatures. And these creatures, in some sense, are, well, it's not that they prop up God's throne. God doesn't need anybody to prop up his throne. But they're there in service to God. And what I think is also interesting about them is the faces. So, and interestingly, when we, in Revelation, I don't know if you picked up on it as Phil read it, but we had four creatures and four faces, the same faces. One like a human, one like an ox, one like a lion, one like an eagle. And when you think of the lion, you think of king of the jungle. When you think, so the lion was the fiercest wild beast. The ox, it kind of ran the farm. It was the strongest domestic beast. Where did the eagle rule? The air. And then the human was given dominion over all the creatures. And so what we have in these kind of four-faced creatures is this one creature that kind of represents every creature. and every domain. So whether it's the sky, whether it's the wild, whether it's the domesticated, we have this four-faced creature that is in service to God. Now, why four-faced creatures? Well, part of what we think is going on there is that they spoke in terms of, you know, kind of the four corners of the earth. And so to have four of them meant that there was no territory that God didn't reign over. So you have all these four-faced creatures representing all of creation, everything that has breath and moves. They are in service to God. And God's sky, if you will, covers the four corners of the earth. That there is no place in which God doesn't reign. No place in which he is not enthroned over it. Now, one more thing with these four living creatures, that this is very different. They move. That in most of the, you know, the ancient art or depiction of this from other cultures, they don't move. They're just kind of static. They're stationary. But these ones, did you pick up on the language? They're darting back and forth and they're moving around and they're, you know, there's stuff like lightning going on between them. And so they're moving about. And so the picture that we begin to get, and it's going to get clearer, the picture that we begin to get is kind of this dynamic rule rather than kind of this static throne. And not only that, but this throne can move into areas. So while the whole world is God's, yet also there is this ability of God to kind of, his throne to kind of move into various areas. And so the next thing that we get to kind of highlight, if you will, this movement, the wheels. So there are four wheels. Well, it's hard to know exactly how to translate. The experts aren't sure whether we got kind of a wheel within a wheel, you know, like a big wheel with the hub inside of it, or whether we have wheels that intersect each other. So you have one wheel going this way and then another wheel going this way and they kind of intersect. I tend to think of almost like casters on a heavy object that you can kind of roll it in different directions. So the wheels in my mind, I'm wanting to know, okay, where are the axles? What's the suspension system? Where are the shocks? But we just got wheels. So you got the wheels, and every living creature kind of has its wheel or wheels, if you will. And the wheels have huge rims, be very, very appropriate for today. And they are full of eyes. Okay, I get my clue. They are full of eyes all around the rim. And what the eyes would represent, they may have been precious stones that look like eyes, we don't know. But probably what the eyes represented was kind of all-seeing, all-knowing, that nothing got past these wheels or these living creatures. Or maybe better, nothing got past God. That all-seeing, all-knowing, could not be deceived. And so you have these wheels that move in conjunction with these four living beings, these four creatures, and these four creatures are holding up the sky, and on that sky there is this throne with one who looks like he's a human being, but like on fire. And he can kind of see above and he sees, you know, burning bronze fire gleaming. He looks below and he kind of sees, you know, more bronze burning, more flame. Can't really see. I mean, the fire is so bright that he can make out that someone is sitting on the throne, but he really can't make out much more beyond that other than that there's just a whole lot of fire and a whole lot of light coming forth from this being. Well, that would be God. And notice the language all throughout the vision is that he's constantly having to say like or as or in the appearance of. So Ezekiel doesn't come right out and say he sees God and this is what God looks like. Instead, he sees one who looks like a human being and looks like fire above and fire below and bronze, and he can't really see. And this is going on all through the vision. And so Ezekiel is seeing something so great that, one, it's hard to look at, and two, it's even harder to describe. And so kind of using the best way I know how to kind of think about it is that he's having to use, or he's seeing, or God's communicating to him in images where God's kind of working from what he knows and trying to reveal to him something that is kind of unknown. It's so when God speaks to him, I'm guessing that God's speaking Hebrew. Why? Well, it's not so much because God speaks Hebrew as much as it is because Ezekiel speaks Hebrew and understands Hebrew. So God's going to speak in his language, even though his language can't really capture everything that God says. So same thing with some of this imagery here. That a lot of the imagery that's being used was somewhat popular, somewhat used in different cultures of the ancient world. He no doubt would have been introduced to some of it while he was in Babylon. But it's like God is saying, okay, I'm going to work from what you kind of know to what's the truth that's even beyond what you know or deeper than what you know. Maybe another way to think about it is poetry. That in poetry, we usually put words in different ways, line them up differently to say something that we couldn't simply say in prose, in a sentence. So God is communicating with him in this kind of imagery. And I know the pizza's coming. The most important thing to get, I better get to that. I think the most important thing to get in all of this is that, where's this happening? It's in Babylon. And the throne of God that's on the sky, that's held up by the four living creatures, is on wheels. And that means that the throne of God is mobile. It's secure, but it's mobile. And so the throne of God, the rule of God, is not confined to Palestine. The throne of God, the rule of God, is not confined to Jerusalem. The throne of God is not confined to the temple in Jerusalem. That here is Ezekiel, 30 years old, feeling like he's in a God-forsaken place, and somehow his life had basically been lost, and he's stuck in this war-torn place. And who shows up on the throne? God does. Doesn't just give him a vision of God up in heaven, but in this vision, it's like the throne of God comes to Ezekiel. God comes to him and reveals to him that he yet reigns even in Babylon. And the whole purpose of it is to let Ezekiel know, I've got work for you to do. And we have the call of Ezekiel. Now, the call of Ezekiel, that's what we're going to be looking at next week. The whole purpose of this opening chapter is to really kind of ground this calling in the rule of God. That God is going to call Ezekiel, of all things, he didn't miss his life's purpose. That God actually has his hand on him there, and God has work for him to do there. And the 20 years that he would have spent serving God in the temple, he is going to spend as a prophet in Babylon. And God is going to work through him in unbelievable ways. But that, I don't want to say that as like it's going to be a dream life. It's going to be a hard life.